This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 3rd of September 2013 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we go back in time in Turkey and then look to the future in Serbia, stopping by the beaches of Goa en route. We'll be paying a visit to Istanbul to investigate the ongoing legacy of one of the Ottoman Empire's most imposing architectural talents.
Some of his masterpieces are in the process of renovation. Fantastic works!
Rio de Janeiro correspondent Sheena Rossiter meets Israeli architect Nir Sivan to discuss a unique new work he is unveiling in a shopping centre in the city.
Basically, we are looking at an architecture, but it is a sculpture, it is an art, it's something I want to give to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
We swing by an important design conference in Goa, India, to meet the brains and the brawn creating waves there last week.
Build a platform and help the evolution of design in India. And that's my goal.
Plus, I chat with Monocle photo director Poppy Shimamoto on the special skills it takes to turn a monthly magazine into a long-lasting hardback book. That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. To start the show, we go to Istanbul. In the history of Turkish architecture, one name hangs over all others. Mimar Sinan was the Ottoman Empire's top architect for almost 50 years. His influence is still formidable, especially as the taste for Ottoman designs is still as strong today as it has been since the Turkish Republic was formed. Homes, commercial buildings, theme parks, and even movies abound with Ottoman themes. Historical figures like Sinan enjoy great prestige in such an atmosphere. But is there something deeper about this nostalgia for the Ottoman Empire's golden age?
The Süleymaniye Mosque in Istanbul was built in the 1550s for the Ottoman Sultan Süleyman I, and it is an architectural masterpiece. This may not be surprising. Süleyman ruled longer and more successfully than any other sultan before or after, and he brought the Ottoman Empire to the peak of its power and glory. So it seems fitting that the mosque he had built in his own name and where he is buried would be such a masterpiece. But the fact was not inevitable. Süleyman's good fortune was appointing a man of special genius to be the empire's chief builder, a man who is today almost as well known as Süleyman himself, that is Mimar Sinan, or Sinan the Architect. Historians believe Sinan built about 500 structures during his career: mosques, palaces, tombs, public kitchens, roadhouses, aqueducts, schools, bridges, and hospitals. Many of these, in Istanbul and beyond, are still standing. The Süleymaniye Mosque and its complex is considered his greatest work in Istanbul. The mosque is beautiful and a technical wonder. Sinan wanted to create as much space as possible under a central dome. The ideal was the Hagia Sophia, not far from the Süleymaniye Mosque itself. But that Byzantine church, and later mosque, was built 1,000 years before Sinan's time.
I'm İpek Akpınar. I'm associate professor at Faculty of Architecture at Istanbul Technical University. For Sinan, I mean, you see in the library there are plenty of books. I'm trying to grasp his bath, Ottoman or Roman bath right now. Some of his masterpieces are in the process of renovation. Fantastic works. I'm trying to look to the typology, to the repetitions. There is no. Each one is unique, or in each one, he borrows something from the past, but he's challenging the former one. He's adding something new, and he's challenging himself, actually. So each time, he's another level in the game. Probably he was an excellent chess player. I mean, each time some new positionings, new structural systems. Yeah. In each mosque or bath, he was playing with the number of domes or semi-domes. The plan is never the same. Although the material is the same, stone, Each time there are two different aspects. Space is different, structural system is different, and it is fantastic, and it is.
Sinan was born to Christian parents near Kayseri in central Anatolia. His original name was Joseph. When he was around 20 years old, Joseph was drafted into the service of the empire through the Devshirmi, or collection program, by which Christian youth were converted to Islam and trained to run the imperial state. Joseph became Sinan. He also became a soldier and soon a decorated commander. He was a veteran of the Ottoman campaigns that pushed the borders of the empire to the gates of Vienna. His success as a combat engineer recommended him to top Ottoman officials, and in 1538, at the age of almost 50, Sinan was appointed chief architect of the Ottoman Empire. He stayed in the post for another 50 years, until his death, aged almost 100.
Alors, y a un effort pour,
There is an effort to put valor into Sinan's heritage, but this is not a very methodical or scientific approach. Sinan has become a sort of icon for Ottoman architecture, a hero, that of Turkish genius, which of course is a bit of a false and still debated theme.
Jean-François Perus is the director of the French Institute for Anatolian Studies in Istanbul.
Et je crois que cette utilisation idéologique de Sinan empêche d'entrer dans la complexité de son œuvre.
I think that this ideological use of Sinan prevents us from entering into the actual complexity of his works and to recontextualize it. This reading misses the phenomenon of who he was, of his personal life, of the environment he worked in.
The modern Turkish Republic, founded in 1923, has always had a complicated relationship with its own history. And perhaps, like most countries, it is a relationship often burdened by ideology and taboo. School books have emphasized the abrupt and radical change from the Ottoman Empire to Turkish Republic. Many people raised in this republican spirit could perhaps be forgiven the view that the Ottoman Empire was as far from modern Turkey as a foreign country. But the Ottoman Empire was never fully rejected by the new state, and certainly not forgotten.
So probably for our grandfathers, it was very complicated. Can you imagine one day you were in one country, the day after you were in another one? It is the same in the daily life, but it is not the same. Or the perception from the top down, they were trying to change.
Not surprising then that Ottoman nostalgia has been in vogue before. It seems the nostalgia offers some certainty in uncertain times. Even later Ottoman governments turned to the classical Ottoman architecture of Sinan's era for inspiration as their empire was collapsing. And the military regime that ruled Turkey in the early 1980s put Sinan's image on Turkish money and named the country's preeminent fine arts university after the architect. And these are just a couple of examples.
Whenever the period is very ambiguous, it's difficult, so back to the past, back to the classical period. It happened in the mid-20th century.
In 1950, Adnan Menderes became Turkey's first democratically elected leader. 10 years later, he was executed following a coup d'etat.
When Menderes had put lots of censorship, when he became extremely totalitarian towards the end of the decade, his rhetoric showing respect towards the Ottoman increased. What we witness today actually, an extreme power respect, not only towards Ottoman, right now towards the Seljuki period of the medieval ages. We don't have effective archive measurements, drawings from the Seljuki period. We don't know civilian architecture. It is not well documented, but there is some cliche images, some doors, some images from the structural system, some ruins. So right now, in not only the public buildings, but also in some civilian buildings, like shopping malls, etc., those figures, those elements are borrowed in terms of material without any intellectual background. By the revival of some historical buildings or by using some historical elements to think that history can be revived is a very tragic attitude.
There are many reasons for this, of course. Social scientists should explore this problem.
Murat Gül is Associate Professor of Architecture at Tobe University of Economics and Technology in Ankara.
What we can say that, yes, the newly emerging bourgeoisie in the cities are very keen on the nostalgia, and they think that the history can be created with the reconstructing of a palace, reconstructing of a bridge, or making something new totally, but using the retrospective styles, nostalgic styles. The thing is that that attitude, retrospective architectural styles, are not limited to current government or the prime minister, but has much more acceptance from different segments of the society. I mean, it is also interesting, as we know, the neoclassicism had a big popularity in the 19th century in Europe, especially in England. And look at what happened in England in the 19th century. Urbanization, rapid development, economic improvements, but also social problems. What is happening in Turkey today is rapid population boom, industrialization, economic improvements. Look at the number of churches in England constructed in the 19th century. They boomed. I think the social circumstances, economic circumstances brought those architectural preferences. We cannot perhaps say that entirely depends on this, but I think there are some impact of the social context on the architectural preferences of the ruling elite.
It may be comforting or politically useful during unsteady times to look back to a romanticized past when all was grand and defined by accomplishment. And even during such times, the past was a heavy presence. Sinan himself spent many of his days trying to figure out how to build something better than a mosque that was already 1,000 years old by the time he had laid eyes on it. But if there is one thing that is just as obvious as Turkey's nostalgia for the golden age of the Ottoman Empire, and perhaps it was the same during past waves of similar nostalgia, it is that what is admired is literally superficial. It is the surface of things, and not the underlying drives, such as those of Sinan himself, to master and then innovate, to constantly push the limits of technology. This, after all, is something quite different than nostalgia, and is in fact the embrace of uncertainty itself. For Monocle, in Istanbul, I'm Caleb Lala.
Lots more coming up, including the Goen Design Conference that's getting global attention.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus. Creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. And for those just joining us, you're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, here on Monocle 24. Rio de Janeiro is commonly known by its nickname, the Marvelous City. And if you've been lucky enough to visit the Brazilian city, it's not hard to see how it earned this name. With its rolling, lush, green mountains that hug the seaside, amid a dash of samba in between, the fusion of landscape and culture can really inspire. That was the case for Israeli architect Nir Sivan with his latest project, the Carioca Wave. The functional sculpture Sivan has designed will sit in the middle of the biggest design and decoration shopping area in Latin America, Rio's Casa Shopping. Monocle correspondent Sheena Rossiter visited the site where the Carioca Wave is being built to talk to Nir Sivan about the structure and the inspiration behind it.
Welders and builders busily work away under the scorching winter sun in Rio de Janeiro's Barra da Tijuca. These workers here at the Casa Shopping Design Complex are putting together 110 tons of imported glass and steel to bring the end product into fruition. The Carioca Wave, what will be the first free-form structure in South America.
Basically, we are looking at an architecture, but it is a sculpture, it is an art, it is something I want to give to the city of Rio de Janeiro.
Israeli architect Nir Sivan designed the Carioca Wave. He's a long way from Rome, the city he now calls home and where his architecture firm is based. But this project, he hopes, will be the first of many in Brazil. He explains where the inspiration for his design came from.
Brazil attracted me for such a long time, but when I got the opportunity to do this project, I understand I have to do something that will merge with the environment, that will be inspired from the environment and will be a part of it, not just landed here. I got the idea of having something in a movement, a wave, just sitting next to the seaside in Barra de Tijuca, starting drawing, developing my idea, and this is what we see here. So at the upper part, at the right part, we see the starting area of the waves. We see a calm area, we can go up, you can see how the sculpture is moving. You can see the dynamic lines of it at this part here. So at this part here, basically this represents the beginning of the wave. We are building a pool, an enormous pool here with water. Above the pool, we are constructing the initial phases of the wave when the waters is still calm and not going up. And then it will start going up as you see it, and then it will be filled with glass, forming the wave going up in this direction and that direction, double curvaturing. This is a surface which I developed, double curvature, as a sculpture, drawing by hand, develop it with many architecture, artistic technologies and methods.
He takes me around the site and describes what shoppers will see and experience here next month when the structure is complete.
Going back to the shape, we can see how it's smooth here in this area just above the water. This water will be illuminated with blue because this is the deep water. And then it starts to go up, the shape starts to go up because the wave is forming. You see how the curvatures are changing, how the angles, how the external border are going up, then to the other side, and then we will visit the other side where the wave comes down and flashes and becomes white water. So this really stimulates the entire movement of a wave. And this sculpture is actually have no columns. This is why it's so special. It's just one surface starting from one side, going up, and all cantilever to the other side. Now we are proceeding to the lower part where the wave breaks and becomes white water. This is the lower area of the shop. Cars come in here, but goes to the side of the canopy, can go down, can park around the canopy, and can go down even one more floor and park there. And in this floor we have shopping stores. So you see the wave coming down and you feel the same atmosphere. We're gonna have a pool around here as well. So as I said, this crashes and becomes white water. So we're gonna have a pool with white stones and movement of water. So it will give you the appearance of the white water.
Creating a project this ambitious seems to be a dream come true for any architect. But it hasn't been an easy task. Each piece of the 500 panels that make up the surface of the structure had to be imported from Austria, and they're all different shapes. Actually, some of the workers even had to be imported to help build the structure, since some of the technologies used are still unfamiliar here in Brazil. Needless to say, it's been a delicate project since construction started back in March of this year. But the use of new and innovative technologies, like software systems used to design cars, is what made this project possible. And with the structure sitting at the center of the design complex serving several functions, the project is considered to be a success.
In order for a project to be successful, it has to have more than one aspect. It has to have many aspects. It's a design, but it's becoming a symbol now.
Nir says that the Carioca wave is a tribute to what Rio de Janeiro will become in the coming years.
It started in 82. In 82, there were only water in this area, not much residential. And it was developed pretty fast. Nowadays, it has a lot of residential area. Maybe not famous for great architecture, but is becoming pretty much dense from the population. The quality of life is pretty high. The sea is very nice. It's going to be the center of the Olympic Games as well. So means many people will come. Fortunately, we're going to have the BRT soon. So it's going to be connected with the center of the city. And so this is a very important part of the extension of Rio de Janeiro, and this is a tribute I'm so fortunate to give to this place.
It's clear that Nir Sivan isn't scared of an ambitious project, and that this is just the start of things for him here in Rio, as he looks to set up an office permanently in Brazil.
I am on this wave, we can say, on this wave of success of developing practically Rio de Janeiro, and this is part of something that helps me and inspired me and so on. But I like to see myself as a part of the population, and so I'm not seeing myself as an architect that's coming from another country just do a project for whatever reason and goes away. I'm trying to see myself as a part of it, and as we said, to open an office and to be a part of the future of the city.
For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. And now it's time for our weekly nose round the studio of a designer. Today we go to Shoreditch in London's East End to meet the team at Vitamins Design, who took us round their work, or rather invention space. We spoke to Clara Gaggiero, Adrian Westaway and Duncan Fitzsimmons about their working day, technology and a bit of magic too.
We are at the Vitamin Studio in Fournier Street in Spitalfields.
And we found it because we were actually, well, Clara was just walking on Brick Lane Market and there was a post-it note on the window, and just with a mobile number, she phoned up, and then it was some sort of this like ridiculously amazing kind of studio that was full of junk. Clara and Duncan came to visit and they couldn't even see the studio. They had to look at the four corners of the ceiling and say, well, this is pretty big, we'll take it. And then we had to like strip everything down, sand the floorboards, everything. It was really good fun. Like, we had a good time.
We already had a vision of what we wanted our studio to be like in our previous studio building. This just fitted better with the vision, I think. So everything sort of up and moved, and here we are.
We've got these crazy electronic door locks that we got from eBay Korea, which were basically answering quite a specific problem that we didn't want to all be walking around with hundreds of keys with us, because there's lots of doors in the studio that we have for different things. So like all like sort of functional things like the secret bookshelf, and they all kind of work in some way, you know, that they solve some sort of problem. But then on the other side, there's quite a lot of emotional kind of, a bit like, you know, designing your home. There's some stuff that you don't really justify. You just stick up because it makes you happy.
Mm-hmm. It's good. It's a project that we never finish, and it's quite fun to have one that, you know, you can always keep on working on when you have some time.
Mm-hmm. I think our last studio had more of a kind of industrial feel to it. Here's a sort of a more, you know, it's in a building that was once, you know, a home and a shop, and it's a more comfortable working environment. But at the same time, we've still got all the mad inventors elements here, there and everywhere. You know, there's all sorts of strange technologies and things in every corner there.
We can actually show you, probably just if you're just looking from here, like a kaleidoscope, which is always nice. Duncan found this amazing Victorian invention book, which is just always on the table. Every time we put it away on the bookshelf, it just comes back to the table because we keep looking at it. And then we've got, like, you know, we kind of mix a lot of like high tech stuff and low tech stuff. So there's like old like mechanical calculators, but then we've got like, you know, brand new electronics circuits, you know, sensors, stuff that we make. So usually we just surround ourselves with as much stuff as possible. We do surround ourselves with things that are quite fantastical, and usually by mixing two or three or four of them together, you get even more fantastic things. So like, we do have a lot of like strange little inventions around the studio, and we have a sort of anyone has a veto essentially, where you, as long as it's some weird invention, you can buy it basically. Like, nobody has to, nobody can say no. So as a result, we have weird things.
It's, you know, what we do is, you know, we're designing new things and new experiences, new interactions. In order to be able to do that, you have to always know what's the latest new things that are possible to do.
We have designed a way of organizing ourselves, or like, I think you call it a resource management system. But it's actually a calendar made of Lego, and it's going to be, I think, launched
in a month. We can show it to you after. It's a huge like physical calendar made of Lego bricks. And we kept just looking at the way that we were working and spying on each other, and we just worked out, invented this new sort of way of organizing ourselves, But it's really simple. It's really fun because it uses Lego, obviously. But it's also connected to the internet in a really sort of magical way. By just taking photos of the calendar, it automatically sends all of the data to our online calendars. And it just means we have to have Lego on our desk at all times, basically, which is always nice. We do a lot of research in every project that we do, and it's you know, as interesting as the designing, and as important. And as a result, we're just constantly experiencing new things, meeting new people all the time, different countries. We try and not do any research in the studio.
That's kind of the best way to do it, is to take a designer and parachute them into something else, so they get to completely experience and learn from that.
We love this song, Plink Plank Plunk, by Leroy Anderson, I think, but maybe that's wrong. But we love Plink Plank Plunk. It's just it was a really beautiful song that we chose when we were making a film about one of our inventions, just because it seemed to just really capture the sort of like delight in the invention.
That was the team at the studio Vitamins Design. Still to come in part two, Guy Delaunay meets the developers behind Zaha Hadid's newest project, a big-scale vision for city centre Belgrade. We'll also find out how to live better, in pictures at least, with Monocle's photo director Poppy Shibamoto. Monocle's first ever hardback book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living, is just about to hit the shelves. Published by Gestalten, over 400 pages are devoted to one of the magazine's ongoing main themes, how to live well. I caught up with Monocle photo director Poppy Shibamoto to discuss how she helped put the book together. We chatted about the challenges of editing photography for a heavyweight tome compared to doing a monthly magazine.
Okay, so this is something that I asked myself when we were doing this book project. And, you know, like it was going to be some archive and it's going to be some new photograph. So I was thinking they need to blend in together, obviously. Then also, like, what would readers want to see in a book differently from magazine? But then it comes back to, like, sort of Monocle photography tastes. And when we are commissioning a magazine, we always look for images that's going to stay for long and stay for someone's mind for long. And also it's something that it doesn't change with the trend of photography or how... what people wears or the hairstyle, you know, like we shoot in a way that is quite straightforward and simple. So that style of photography that we do for Monocle magazine kind of works for book as well. So it's something, it's going to last. That's the one thing I looked for in the book as well. But that was there already, so that was quite easy to do that job.
So what was the process? I mean, obviously, there's a whole wealth of an archive of photography to choose from, and the same with the stories. But, I mean, how much of it was commissioned fresh for the book? How much did you sort of dip into the back onto the server for? What was the sort of process that you went through?
I think it's a lot of these stories are actually archived stories, but 30 to 40% are freshly commissioned new stories. Mm-hmm. And obviously, all the images are re-edited. So I chose something that is... you know, that obviously we can't include the shops that's closed or people that doesn't exist. So like, so we have to re-edit all the images. So it's all kind of new edit of pictures. But I think 60 to 70% are archive, and then newly shot images are 30 to 40%.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you were doing this as we were closing the big summer issue. How was
65.
That?
65. Oh, it wasn't easy.
Your but back's we've still got in trouble.
We got two more in the photo department, so it's not impossible. Somehow we finish always.
And besides the portrait of yourself, what are some of your favourite images in the book or some of your favourite stories?
Oh, it's hard to choose. I mean, the first section of cities that we chose, 10 cities that you want to live in. Mm. And it was quite different from how we usually choose the quality of life issues of 25 cities, because then we've done, I guess... six times of Quality of Life cities.
Yeah.
So in a book, we could just then pick, like, kind of sit back and choose, like, just the 10.
Wow.
What looked good.
Exactly.
And what city do we really want to live in after those 6 years? So that was, I think that's a quite good section.
Mm.
Yeah. And photography is nice there as well. And it's kind of this, Santiago and Andrew edited this, but they edit in a way from like big scale to small scale. So it's quite nice to read sort of like, not in one go, but like open one page, another week, another section, and then find something new.
And how did you go about sort of telling, I mean, particularly towards the back when it goes into Midori House and the world of Monocle, how did you go about telling the story of Monocle with photography?
I mean, that is very difficult because we are, I mean, we don't usually show the backstage. We don't usually show how we print it or how we design it or who's the editor. You know, we don't really show a lot of that. And then that's something we kept it sort of behind the door. And so it's like, this is almost first time we show most of the people who worked for Monocle. And I mean, people had seen the office before, but this is again newly shot, and also radio studio we shot again.
And it's much more personal, so, I think.
Yeah.
Than...
I think it's just kind of a footnote where like, this is how it's been made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think works in the context of this book. And also illustration is, I mean, hugely important to Monocle, the magazine and all the sort of paraphernalia we do around the brand. What sort of illustration have you got in the book? Who have you used? Are sort of our trusted favourites or new guys? Or
basically, we stuck with one guy who does every month editor's letter illustration for Tyler's page. So entire book is sort of branded by his illustration as well. And this was created with that director Rich's idea to just sort of keep it all simple and everything's kind of the same. So like he's done a colour illustration, some of them are little small illustration in black and white. So it kind of breaks the page as well from photography. So in between the pages, there's these nice illustrations.
Mm. And there is a real sort of relationship, isn't there, between the photo desk, the art desk, and in the magazine, just this sort of the pace between imagery.
Yeah. And then, you know, like, and then you can see at the back, like we all sit together. So illustration commission, photography commission, design of the book all goes in
your whip.
One table.
So probably, I mean, you say the sort of the style of Monocle photography hasn't changed over the years. How do you just sort of try and sum up what is Monocle photography? What does the magazine do differently from other magazines?
I can't compare with other magazines. There are so many great magazines. But for Monocle, the things that I look for in choosing photographers or photographies or images are honest, straightforward and simple. So it's no kind of fuss, no kind of decorations or Dutch angle, just straightforward.
What's Dutch angle?
Dutch angle is like, you know, it's in like black and white films, they use it often, like with the Hitchcock films. It's kind of like tilted.
Uh-huh.
So like, it's not leveled. It makes it dramatic. It makes the shot dramatic.
Of course, which more, perhaps you don't need to.
Yeah, so we try not to do that. And something maybe like, something simple, like we want to see how it is and then just a little bit more beautiful than it is, you know, like a beautiful moment that photographer can only see.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
And then somehow
that made it sort of lasting photography style that we do.
Yeah.
So like when you look back on issue one, it still looks kind of relevant now.
Absolutely.
Although, you know, some cities might look different, but the photography itself is just quite simple and honest. So,
and you've got, you know, I don't know how many photographers you've worked with over the years, but it must be into the hundreds in dozens and dozens of cities. How do you go about choosing photographers that understand that visual language? Is it difficult? Is it something that comes a bit easier now, sort of 7 years into doing the magazine?
Yeah, I think when we started with the original photo director, Rose Percy, I think we found it sort of... Initially, it was hard because it was a new thing that we are doing that is, you know, we need to commission photographer everywhere. But now I think we've done so many years that lots of photographers just actually send us email with introduction, with their portfolios. And so it's much easier, you know, photographers who knows our style contacts us as well. So it's getting easier now.
Mm.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And it's summed up brilliantly in this new book.
Yeah, in this new book is, I think, about 150 photographers.
Wow.
Newly commissioned as well as been commissioned before for magazine and we've used images of. And one illustrator. And then there's obviously some special thanks people who contributed, didn't make it to the book because perhaps they were fashion photographer or whatever. But yeah, so that's only sort of like 10% of how many people we might know as a photographer. So yeah, we know lots.
Poppy Shibamoto, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. After this interlude, we'll be hearing from correspondent Aarti Bettigeri at one of the most interesting events on India's design calendar.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Years of scouring the globe for the world's best baristas means Monocle knows what makes a good cafe, which is why we're making a great one, just a stone's throw away from our London headquarters. Tucked away between neighbourhood shops on Chiltern Street and Marylebone, pop in to the Monocle Cafe for freshly baked pastries, simple delicious lunches, or a delectable dessert, all served alongside artfully made coffee, naturally. Have your cake and eat it, in or out, at London's new Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street.
This is Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome back. In India, an annual design conference that's fast making waves internationally was held over the weekend in the seaside state of Goa. The Design Yatra, as it's called, is the yearly industry get-together by the not-for-profit organisation Curious. It brought together more than 1,000 design professionals, creative directors, branding experts, students and independent designers. Monocle's New Delhi correspondent Aarti Bettigeri was there.
There might be a beach just metres away, but for 1,400 industry folk from around India and farther afield, the waves are less of an attraction than the Curious Design Conference. They're here to see a carefully curated lineup of just 20 speakers from around the world, such as Tim Greenhagen of Fitch, Dominic Harris of Cinemod Studio, and projection designer Bart Kreisa. Curious's founder Rajesh Kedriwal began the organisation with some lofty aims to help propel Indian design to the forefront.
The whole objective of Curious as a not-for-profit organisation is to build a platform and help the evolution of design in India. And that's my goal. Somehow take it to this level where, you know, people talk about design in Holland so well. Everything there is done so well. So someday I think India will also reach this stage.
The conference features sessions on topics as diverse as film title design, musical scoring, and how advertising can be leveraged to address social issues. KV Pops is a veteran Indian ad man working for Leo Burnett. He says while Indian design is still in its formative years, things are moving quickly, and the rest of the world is starting to take notice.
India and China are worlds by themselves. You know, at one point in time, globalization meant Americanization. You know, today globalization means understanding India and China, because these two are very, very different nations. If you see India, India is has got its own culture, it has its own sensibility, and it has talent, self-motivated talent, intelligent people, and then you know, knowledge is abundant. We absorb from the world and then apply it to our own. You know, if you see, not just in advertising, but in most of the industries in India, we had very little help coming from outside. And you don't see many expats, unlike any other country, unlike any other Asian countries, that you don't see any expats in India. India developed on its own. It has a huge knowledge base, it has a huge talent base, and the market was not ripe enough. But today the market is really growing. And that's the reason why the focus is on India. It's very, and India is not one country. You know, India is almost 500 different countries, you know, clubbing together. So it's very difficult for anyone else to come and then understand, and it's very difficult even for Indians to understand India completely.
Rajesh Kedriwal also points out the design could potentially be a major export area, produced by India for the world.
I think one of the biggest industries in India that will, let's say, export design in a way, would be illustrations. Because in India, if you see comics, Chanda Mama, this, that, a child grows up with colors, grows up with all of this nature, grows up with these comics, and illustrations in India are beautiful. We've done some illustration showcase, I've shown it to the Western world. Illustration in India is amazing. I think at some point in time, illustration will be exported from India, out of India. And that's one. Typography, especially this Devanagari scripts, etc., but that's more internal than external, but that I think is a big business that's slowly evolving. We are artists, so calligraphy is in our blood in some ways.
It's a sentiment that typographer Sarang Kulkarni agrees with. The Mumbai-based artist is working on producing a range of new scripts that cover a number of different languages, as well as working to digitise existing Indian scripts that were originally developed by calligraphers.
I think it's not a small area, it's a quite a big area in terms of you see letter forms everywhere nowadays. Any small piece of any product or to any big, you know, place, you'll see the letter forms. So only thing is that we need to create an awareness about the typographic aesthetic towards multilingual branding, multilingual communication. So I can see there's a lot of potential in Indian typography in future, because everything is going digital and a lot of documentation happening from manuscripts to books. So I think there's a lot of revival, you know, in terms of typography will happen soon.
Perhaps the star of the conference was Dharamveer Kamboj, an Indian farmer turned rickshaw driver turned inventor. He told the audience of developing a rudimentary yet effective machine to extract juice and oil from fruit and nuts grown in his home village, a device that addresses the actual needs of India's vast rural population. When asked what he'd call the machine, he proudly told the audience of design and branding experts that he'd named it Multipurpose Fruit Pressing Machine. For that, he got a standing ovation. For Monocle in Goa, I'm Aashi Beshigeri.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Zaha Hadid is well known for her striking architectural creations around the world. She's done everything from the Aquatic Centre at the London Olympics to the Central Building for BMW. But Southeast Europe is a new territory for the Iraq-born architect. That should change in the next few years with a development in Serbia's capital, Belgrade. After 5 years of delicate planning negotiations over the city centre site next to the city's ancient fortress, the project is moving on to the next phase. The company behind the project, Lambda Developments, said it has the potential to change the way locals and visitors alike view and enjoy Belgrade. Our correspondent there, Guy Delorney, went to hear their pitch.
Thank you so much for coming. Huge applause, please, to investor.
Boris Stankobelic. I'm running the local office of Lambda Development in Belgrade, Serbia. This used to be basically the end of the city, unfortunately. And it used to be, of course, the large textile company headquarters back in the 30s when it was built. We have a port very close by. We have a big warehouse on the river. The river was not exploited in the way it is today, as the contemporary cities do. So what we're trying to do is actually, and it's a trend that the entire city is trying to do, to reform the banks of the river, because we have two amazing rivers, and it's just unbelievable how unused they are. So the first guys that started was the restaurants in the old warehouses, basically, and they made a nice walkway paths. And then there is a plan also for a Belgrade port in the future to be refurbished. But this is basically the peak of the peak of the city. This is the place that will connect the city with the riverbanks, basically, through an amazing project of Zaha Hadid.
Before we get on to Zaha Hadid, I'm interested in the old Beko building, which is, I wouldn't say it's beautiful, but it is old and it's a landmark. What sort of local sensitivities are are there to consider before you start doing a new project at a location like this?
The building as a building as itself, it's doesn't have any architectural value because it was constructed as a factory for military clothes in the 30s. So it's a very simple square building. But today there is a sentiment about the building because it's been sitting here for the last 70 years, obviously, and it has been incorporated in the project. So the rest of the project will connect itself to the building. We will refurbish the building completely. It will be a 5-star hotel, and it will have this industrial look that will be connected with the residential and the commercial spaces here.
All of this is being designed by Zaha Hadid, who of course has been behind all sorts of iconic projects in many cities around the world. And the model of the project in your office looks like something that's been it's all very white. It looks like something that's been carved from a bar of soap. Lots of swooping curves, not quite sure where one level starts and the next level begins. What are the details of the design?
Well, it's a good point because we had the same issue when we were presenting the design. Planners were trying to understand where the building starts from the ground, actually, and where is it underground. And the thing with Zaha Hadid is why their design is so amazing, because only a few years ago it started to be possible to actually develop such a projects. The architectural and the construction technique was not developed enough for the construction companies to be able to actually make something like that on the construction site. So finally, thanks to the contemporary methods, we are able to do that construction, and it's very curvy, it's very modern, it's very unusual. It's a landmark.
It's a very fluid shape.
Very fluid, yeah.
It looks like a series of ribbons almost.
Yeah.
The other very prominent construction that's in this area is Kalemegdan, the fortress of Belgrade, which has gone through heaven knows how many incarnations over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Mm. But it is a real landmark of the city. It again links the city to the river. You're going to be right next door with this development. How conscious did you have to be that that's there as well?
Well, it's a good point because really Kalemegdan is something that's a real, real landmark for the Belgrade, and I would say pretty much the only one, I mean, of that size. And as you said, we are right next to it, so we really had to be very, very conscious about it. We spend a lot of time discussing with the local authorities. They gave us, let's say, directions which to follow in order to combine these two, because this is going to be, I would say, contemporary landmark for the city. But of course, it's not going to jeopardize an old fortress that's next to it. It's two completely different projects. And to make things really simple, this is going to be a fluid. Kalemegdan is very straightforward fortress. So they're not working against each other. I would say that they're working with each other.
What is happening with regards to the financial elements of the project? You mentioned that when the idea came along, of course, the world was a different place, economically speaking. Right now,
just 5 years.
Yeah, right now, everybody's hurting, and Serbia more than many countries. So is this realistic to go forward with it, or is it a pipe dream?
Well, Lambda Development, it's one of the largest European real estate development companies with a portfolio that's over 1 billion basically. So we are very experienced into real estate development, and especially in I would say luxury real estate development. So we already have discussed with the banks. It's definitely going to be syndicated financing from the banks, and they're interested, and that's the reason why they're interested, is because Zaha Hadid. Actually, so everybody wants to be the part of that project, which is such a tremendous project for this part of Europe. So I would say the difference between 5 years and now is that 5 years ago we would finance this by ourselves or maybe with one more bank, but in these days we will have to finance with I would say few different banks, so it's going to be a syndicated financing. And the way we see it, this is a project that will start happening soon.
London's got the Shard and the Gherkin. Are you giving this one a name?
We'll see.
Go on, have a go. What do you think it would be? Not the layer cake. It's too wobbly and ribbony.
We'll see.
Guy Delaunay there. Today's show is produced by Ella John and David Pleasant and edited by Holly Fisher and James Bacon. You can contact the producer Aled at awj@monocle.com if you want to feature on Section D. I'm Tom Morris, and playing you out, carrying on with the Monocle Books theme of how to live better, here's Perfect World by Beth Ditto. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.